Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Amongst the choices, well, you can catch up on the 50th anniversary of The Wicker Man. You could watch Sofia Coppola's breakthrough movie, The Virgin Suicides. Treat yourself to a bit of family fun with a Shaun the Sheep movie, Farmageddon. Maybe let off some steam with 1990's Total Recall. We're doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast. For this episode, I'm joined by Scroobius Pip for a bit of a spooky special. Scroobius Pip is a person of many talents, podcaster, musician, writer, actor, and a huge movie fan. Now, I'm going to be talking to him about one or two of his favourites in just a minute. But firstly, here's a clip from Attack the Block, one of his main choices to set the scene.
Excuse me, but what is that?
Scroobius, a big welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. If you can just give us a little bit of a nerdy film fact about yourself.
I mean, it's a weird one.
Perfect.
Because it's unexpected, but one of the films that was one of my first film obsessions, really, and is still in my top five films, I'd say, of all time, is Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't seem to get listed in a lot of things because it's so known for just the Bee Gees soundtrack, but it made me obsessed with John Travolta, and I currently have two John Travolta mirrors in my toilet. I've had them for years. So, that was the peak of my obsession.
I mean, your toilet is much bigger than mine if you can fit two John Travolta mirrors in there.
No, you know those ones like you used to get at fun fairs and stuff? That'll be a small mirror, but it's got like a print on it.
Okay.
It'd often be like a sexy lady or it'd be advertising cigarettes or something, like those old 70s type, cheap type mirrors. And I've got two with John Travolta on, so yeah.
Well, the next episode of this podcast, I'm going to challenge whoever the guest is to have at least three mirrors or they're not coming
on.
100%. When we talked about you coming on this podcast and we talked about the many Studio Canal films that you were interested in, the one that bubbled up, I think for both of us fairly quickly, was Attack the Block.
Yes.
From 2011. And I can see already there is a massive smile on your face just at the thought of talking about Attack the Block. Can you set the scene for the film for us and also how it came into your life?
Or how it came into my life. It's one of the reasons it means so much to me, because it was the first film premiere I ever got to go to.
Oh, okay.
So I'd got to know Nick Frost because he was a fan of my music.
Yeah.
And he invited me and Dan Lesac along to the Leicester Square premiere. And I've never been to anything like that before. I'm a massive film nerd. In general, to be honest, I like a quiet cinema. I like a daytime visit. But yeah, this was hugely exciting. And we kind of walked in on the red carpet, sat down in our seats, and then in front of me came in a Jonathan Ross and his family, and he looked at me and went, oh, he shook my hand and said, Dan Lesac, big fan. I'm not Dan Lesac. Dan Lesac's the guy I used to work with who was sat directly next to me at the time, but we were too polite to correct. It's like, oh, cool, man, thank you. And then we sat down and settled into what was just a joy of a film, of a cinema experience. And it is one of those films that feels like it's a real cinema experience. So yeah, I guess that's how I was introduced to it. To introduce the audience to it, it was the first film I saw that brought horror to the kind of hood, to the streets, to the black working class community. And we've also obviously had things like Get Out and Us and loads of other stuff since then that really has built this amazing genre and offered us some classics that are a mixture, as I said, of horror, of sci-fi, of all these things. But yeah, Attack the Block was my first introduction to those worlds kind of crossing over. A lot of horror for a long time was incredibly white and, yep, you know, posh white people or redneck white people. So, yeah, it was great to bring these worlds together, I guess.
I remember when I saw it for the first time, it was in nowhere near as glamorous a situation as you. But yeah, I was writing and reporting on film at the time, and there seemed to be a struggle about how to categorise it.
Yeah.
That it got put into the cult classic box fairly quickly. I remember sitting watching it thinking, this is a big, massive mainstream film. It just happens to have been done on quite a tight budget. You say you agree. I mean, is that kind of the impression you always got of it?
Yeah, 100%. I think anything that doesn't have the marketing budget of a blockbuster gets put under the cult classic title quite quickly if it's, yeah, enjoyed, because it's hard to categorise. But yeah, I completely agree. I think what Joe Cornish did on that budget was just astounding. I thought the monsters looked amazing. I've spoken to Joe about it on my podcast, and it was simply all these alien attack movies or horror movies are always seem to attack quite white suburban areas.
Yeah.
And he wanted to see how the hood would handle that, how the streets would react if aliens started turning up.
Wherever you're going, I'm coming with you. After what you put me through tonight, it's the least you can do.
No way, man. She's bare annoying. Make her leave. Let that snitch get murked.
Dennis, man, why are you acting like such a prick for? I need the nurse. Do you want me to die?
You can't stand around here arguing. We need to roll now.
My name's Sam.
Jerome.
I'm Pursed.
No, man.
Dennis.
You're Moses, right?
You're gonna need a weapon.
What I like about, of the many qualities of the film, it almost goes back to the original Alien, I think, because if you listen to the crew just sitting around talking in the original Alien movie, they're just moaning about working conditions and day-to-day, yeah, kind of stuff, and it means you believe them.
Yeah.
And the grounding of the characters in Attack the Block is very much that to me. I mean, they write in about nurses' pay, and I think Nick Frost at one point observes that Blockbuster Video is shutting down, and this, it sounds like really trivial bits of stuff. It makes it real, doesn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's also the kind of the enemy of my enemy is my enemy is my friend type vibe, because yeah, again, it starts, yes, out as at that point, you know, we'd just come out of the demonizing of hoodies,
yeah,
calling children who wear hoodies as a descriptor of who they are,
yeah,
and we were just coming out of that, but it frames itself at the start as this kind of, are the hoodies the bad guys? And then by the end, you know, as said, your nurse character and your hoodies as such and everyone is coming together because there's a far greater enemy. But I completely agree. I think getting the mundanity of life in there is always a great way of drawing you in, particularly when it's sci-fi, when there is going to be something that's hard to relate to.
Yeah.
And again, you've used Alien as a perfect example there. Alien was one of the first films where you're like, right, well, this is literally on a spaceship.
Yeah.
You know, a galaxy far, far away as such. But with your Star Wars and that, you weren't necessarily meant to relate. And they made it relatable because it was just working people. It was basically factory workers,
yep,
who happened to be on a factory that's in space. And this had that same thing. Yeah, it kind of, those small gripes and moans really draw you in and make you relate to what is going to be a completely unrelatable film at some point.
Well, I love the fact as well that, I mean, much has been made of the clever subversive nature of Attack the Block, but it does lean into exactly what the cliche would lead you to expect at the start, and then actually does something really clever and tangible with it.
Yeah. And I always wonder with films like that, how much was intended at the start and how much came naturally. This is going to anger film fans now, but I've always had a big belief that David Lynch kind of does a load of stuff and then his fan base explain it all and he goes, yep, that's what I meant. That's what I meant there.
I'm going to put your home address at the end of this podcast now and everyone can track you down.
Yeah. I'm just a big believer in it. But again, I think I love that with films. I love watching a film, and as a screenwriter myself, I love watching a film and kind of trying to figure out what this film started as and what it ended as. If this was the full concept, or if, yeah, this started as this and then turned into this, if it was just a hood sci-fi, and then there was the decision to add kind of a social commentary, a literal hierarchy because it's in a tower block and all these things, and where they'd go with that.
Alert the media. Exclusive rights to the highest bidder.
The Sun, fam. Sun believes anything.
No. The Sun will just dress it up like one of them Page Three girls, bruv.
Nah, you want to call the Guardian, blood? If it's a proper paper, then people will believe it.
Our tabloids pay more money, bruv.
Can't call the paper. FBI will confiscate it off us.
FBI? This is England, fam. There ain't no FBI. It's Section 6 or something.
We need an expert to verify that thing, you know.
Hey, look in the Yellow Pages and look for them, like, all those scientist people know about all them meteor things.
Yellow Pages? Like what? A for aliens?
It's no secret that Joe Cornish lent into the area in which the film is set, both for its locations and also for its casting. I mean, the underappreciating art of film casting is it's never really talked about enough.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much getting a really informed, a really realistic and raw cast did have that kind of impact on the film.
You've touched upon arguably the most important part, because you've got to remember, Joe Cornish is a middle-class white man. So,
yeah.
You know, he needed that cast and that voice to give that authentic nature to it. The language, the way everyone interacts and talks, absolutely crucial. I've worked a couple of times recently with Jermaine Hunter,
yeah.
who broke out in Attack the Block. And again, from everything I've heard, it felt like a real family.
Yeah,
you know, it felt like they got everyone together, and then the film almost came out of that. But yeah, I completely agree. It's weird, isn't it? Because it really echoes that this isn't the cult classic type film, because on your kind of on your Shane Meadows type films, everyone yeah. will be talking about the casting and how amazing yeah. it is that they found these people and street casting and all these other things. Whereas because this does actually, rather than cult classic area, it feels like a blockbuster, it's not talked about as much. That there's so many new names in there, so many who have gone on to absolute greatness, and yeah, it's crucial.
I mean, Jodie Whittaker had broken through, hadn't she? I think it was Venus a few years before, opposite Peter O'Toole. I mean, she was vaguely on the map at this point. John Boyega, whoever the casting team was who found him and yeah. found the others, they're the ones who don't get given awards, right?
I mean, or that's it, and they 100% should, because you've got to look at whether this is a horror or a sci-fi. One of the leads went on to be essentially a lead in Star Wars, and
yes.
one went on to be Doctor Who.
Yes.
So it's like it's the pinnacle of sci-fi has all come out of this. And Jodie Whittaker had broken through, but this was one of those standout moments. And I love when we have these films that, as you say, have this low budget but just get embraced. Like it felt it was instantly embraced, and it felt like it was, yeah.
Yeah.
instantly considered a classic.
I ain't seen you around there before, you know. You lived there long?
A couple of months.
Nice place you got.
Thanks. Thinking of moving.
Shame. Why?
I don't like the area.
Now, what do you mean you don't like the area? And what's wrong with the area?
I grew up in the West Midlands, and the only film I remember shooting in the West Midlands around the time that I was growing up was a small horror film called I Bought a Vampire Motorcycle,
right.
which had Michael Elphick in it.
Yeah.
And it's the only point of reference I had to filmmaking in my locality when I was growing up. Mm. How important do you think it is to an area that a film depicting that area is also shot in that area?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think partly because it's the biggest annoyance ever if something is slightly off and slightly inaccurate.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a big fan of all your superhero films, but it infuriated me when Thor was getting on the tube and it wasn't right.
I knew you were going to say Thor and the tube.
It's like it's the simplicity of it. It's like that's you've got hundreds of millions. Just get it factually accurate. But it's an inspiration as well. And at this point, we'd had films like Kidulthood and Ill Manners and stuff like this, but that's very much one genre and one representation of these communities and these areas. So I think it's hugely important to be putting sci-fis in there, horrors in there, and kind of
yeah.
really showing the variation and the depth.
I love the fact too that the one film they directly reference in the movie is 28 Days Later,
yeah,
which is the only other film I can think of in that period of time, even in that decade either side, that tried to do something like this, yeah, on this kind of scale.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And it's weird how these things don't seem to spawn a load similar, if you know what I mean? Because it's yeah, so odd. When any of these films come out, the with all the love and excitement around Everything Everywhere all at once,
yeah,
we're probably not going to now get a whole slew of absolutely genre-bending, no-rules filmmaking. And that's weird.
Yeah.
Like, in music, if Lily Allen blows up, then we get Adele and Kate Nash and Little Boots and so many other people in that kind of area and realm. And we don't necessarily always get that with film.
See? Is that a dog?
No.
No, that is not a dog.
That's black. Too black to see. That's the blackest black ever, fam. That's blacker than my cousin Femi.
This is a really funny movie as well.
Yeah.
If I had a favourite bit, the only character who gets told off for swearing in the entire film is Jodie Whittaker's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just beautiful.
Or just all of the humour just flows so beautifully. Like John Boyega shows his diversity all in this one film as an action lead, a comedy lead, and a romantic lead, all in one performance. And then I'll never not enjoy Nick Frost playing a bit of a stoner. He's an expert in the field. He can play loads of other things as well, but that particular area and kind of character is just a joy to watch. And again, it's got that authentic feeling to it.
Ah, lovely fireworks. Mommy, it's an alien invasion.
Of course it is.
Let's get down there, cuz.
Let's get tooled up, blood.
Come.
Hey, somebody call pest control.
Yeah, I'm gonna blink.
Quite sweet, really, aren't they?
The other point I wanted to raise about this, it tends to get bracketed as this low-budget film that overperformed and just almost broke out of its box. How good are the aliens in it?
Yeah.
What a lesson that is. Again, you've got a tight budget, and so you focus on the bits that are really going to creep people out.
They do a good job on holding off in the alien and Jaws nature.
Yeah.
But when they do reveal it, how different would this film be? It's mad how crucial that is. How different would this film be if the aliens were disappointing?
Yeah.
It's an impossibly important bit. The design of them, the kind of blue neon-y glow and tinge that they have, it sets the tone for the whole, like the poster is like they're not in it, but it's got that glow, and it's absolutely crucial and
yeah,
an underratedly hard thing to do, because since Alien, how do you make an alien? Because Alien nailed it. It's like how do you make something new and creative, and just the form of them and the shape of them is, it's astounding.
You as a screenwriter as well, I do wonder with Attack the Block, if the budget had been twice what it was, would that have made it a worse film? Were those brackets really important to it?
Potentially. From my time in music video direction, I know the biggest videos I've had that have had the most views and helped me the most have been ones where I had basically no budget and had to be really creative.
Yeah.
Had to come up with something. And we had other videos over the years where we had a bigger budget and we could get more established directors in, and they didn't have the same heart and passion in them. But it makes me curious as to how the new Attack the Block could be and could land, because as you say, it is now this cult classic. So is there going to be, if the follow-up does happen, which it seems to be doing, will the money help it or hinder it? You know
what? So this was announced, I think it was first revealed officially in 2021. I think I got the first talk of Attack the Block 2, which should surely be called Attack the Blocks.
Yeah.
Before we go Attack the Block 3, Attack the Block Resurrection. I mean, there's a whole through line we can do there.
Yeah.
But when I saw the news, it was important. It felt important that it was Joe Cornish and John Boyega as a creative partnership.
Yeah, 100%. Because as I said, I can't. It always has to be said with the most respect for Joe Cornish, as a massive Joe Cornish fan, someone I can't get enough of. But this film wouldn't have worked if it was purely his voice behind it. It was finding John and Jermaine and numerous others who were given that freedom to be lads on an estate.
Yeah.
And mess about. And, you know, there has to have been so much improvisation and so much freedom in the scripts to get that atmosphere and vibe that they got. So now both John and Joe have gone off and done so many amazing things. I love the idea of them coming back together to see where it goes. It gives you faith in it, right? It's one of those ones. It's a weird one that when these announcements come, I can never explain my instant reaction, but it will always be either, oh yes, or I'd leave it alone. And this was one that was like, oh yeah, this sounds good. This sounds,
yeah,
this could be fun.
Because, I mean, I quite like Jaws too, but you can tell it's not Spielberg's Jaws.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Jaws 3D, I mean, by that point, we're far... That's what they should do, attack the block 3D with a fake shark halfway through.
I love it.
We can sort this. You've got his number, right?
I'd be up for that. I'll give him a shout. And the beauty of the third in the trilogy and Joe being such a nerd is you're kind of meant to mess that one up so they could really steer into that.
Listen, whatever kind of gang war bullshit you're involved in, leave me out of it, please.
Hey, this ain't got nothing to do with gangs.
Or drugs, or rap music, or violence in video games.
This is the worst night of my life.
Feelings mutual.
You talked just before about the amount of improvisation and the amount of space that they must have had on the set.
Yeah.
The other crucial thing here is it's 88 minutes.
Mm.
This is really razor tight. And it feels to me like there must be a two-hour cut out there somewhere. I mean, we had a 10th anniversary cinema re-release and it was the same film. And it's not the kind of film anyone's gone back and touched a frame of.
I love an under 90-minute film, though. And it feels like
especially at my age, that's just gold.
Yeah, I can't get enough of it. It is an embarrassing buzz when I see that. And again, I watch so many films that are far longer than that. But there is always that little, I guess, the non-film nerd in me that goes, oh, 88 minutes. Oh, okay, lovely. that's spot on.
Can you just lend some of your music expertise just to that side of the film?
Yeah.
If you can just talk to us just a little bit about the soundtrack to it.
Yeah, I think the soundtrack and all of it, the tone all sits so well together, the soundscapes and the soundtrack, so we get the authentic feeling of that area, of that community. But then it's essential that, like, the aliens have to sound right, and not necessarily only their noises, like the kind of synth and the glow as they appear, the swell and the vibe and that general sinister tone. It's audio and visual. There are films, I think after Drive, there was a period where so many films had that kind of synthy electronic sound. And it's got to match and be right. So, like, I love that. I love that sound, but it's got to match. And I think Joe did the perfect balance here of the right feel and the right sound, rather than just going, I'm really into this at the moment. Here's how I want my film to look and sound or whatever.
Before we move off Attack the Block to another film we just wanted to briefly talk about, can you take us right back to where you started? You went to the premiere of this.
Yeah.
What was it like sat in the room of that? Because this wasn't a film where you'd had 15 trailers that spoiled everything beforehand. The spoilers weren't all over the internet at that point. I would imagine for most people in the room, it was a flat-out surprise.
It was amazing. And the biggest kind of reveal I can give is that I went to see it at the Ritzy in Brixton because I wanted to make sure I wasn't just caught up in the premiere buzz. I'd never been to a premiere. Like, did I love this film because I'm there and everyone who made it is there and there's an after party and it's all, everyone's excited. So I went to watch it again in a regular cinema to make sure I wasn't swayed.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was amazing. Joe was an unknown entity then. Forget the film. Joe Cornish in that world was an unknown entity, and obviously tied in with Edgar and Nick and Simon and all this lot, but you had no idea what kind of director he would be. So
yeah,
I was surprised. I didn't expect this Hood film. And again, there's a lot of actors who you're being introduced to,
who presumably are in the room with you when you're watching it.
Yeah, exactly. The mad thing there's probably people you didn't notice when you walked in who you notice when you walk out. Do you know what I mean? Because they're so new to you.
Yeah.
So it's that weird thing of on the way in, John Boyega was probably just some guy walking in. And on the way out, it was like, wow.
There's a new movie star.
Yeah.
Everyone walks past Jonathan Ross on the way out and just goes straight to him.
Yeah, exactly.
Love it.
Exactly.
When we were emailing backwards and forwards about films that you wanted to talk about, you did also mention another. I just want to briefly dig into your brain on, because you highlighted the 2014 movie, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that's a film, even though it had a reasonable amount of profile, very few people listening have actually seen. Mm. And so I wonder, can you just introduce why that film is so special?
I mean, it's a perfect one to kind of talk about here, because it's another one where just the tone and the vibe just feels perfect, and you're putting horror into an area I'd not seen it before. So it's essentially an Iranian vampire movie in fairly modern times, and it's just beautiful. It's one of the coolest looking films I've seen. There's so pretty much every frame you could print and have a poster of.
Yeah.
Seeing a young Iranian girl in a hijab skateboarding up the street with, like, the moon just lighting this street. It's just such powerful images and powerful mood. It just... I went in not knowing what to expect at all. And that's, again, it's one that I've played a lot of people. I've recommended to people. And it's always a risky one when it is more arty, more unusual, more out there, but yeah, always amazing response.
That's what genre can do, though, isn't it? If you dig into a genre, it can be a Trojan horse for really broadening people's eyes to an awful lot of cinema.
Yeah, I love that. I love when, I mean, in general, I try to not know too much before I go into a film. I avoid trailers. Ever since the second of Nolan's Batman films, which had an amazing trailer with the stadium blowing up and all of this. But I then went and watched it in IMAX all excited. I was like, oh, I've seen all the best bits. And it broke my heart a little bit. So in general now, because I know I go to the cinema at least a couple of times, or at least once a week, often a couple of times a week, I'm like,
yeah,
I'll go in as blind as possible. And this was one that my brother just handed me a DVD and was like, watch this. So that's how blind I went in. I had the cover, essentially. I had the cover, which, again, it's a beautiful poster. And yeah, just went in completely blind and was just entranced. It's dreamlike. And that's the perfect tone and film for any vampiric story, right? Because there's meant to be a level of dreamy nature, of that control, of hypnotism and that kind of thing. And it feels like you drift through this film wonderfully.
And just as with Attack the Block as well, it's a writer-director behind it, Anna Lily Amanpour. The story goes, she had to crowdfund just to get the film made in the first place. Yeah. It was a battle and a half just to get this movie going.
It's mad. And I've spoke to a few different directors who've had similar. And it's that weird thing, isn't it? Because on the other end of it, it's this amazing journey and success story that they've fought against the odds and made this beautiful thing. It always makes me think how many people didn't make it through that fight. How many amazing films have we missed out on because of the, you know, a few years back it was there, if it's not a superhero movie or if it's not a genre, it can't be made. Now there's a lot of, if it's not a TV series or a miniseries, it's hard to be made. How many amazing films are we missing out on because people don't survive that fight?
I mean, even as we're recording, this is the year we've seen Celine Song's Past Lives break through.
Yeah.
Another debut feature, but it's just what you say. What we're seeing is the 1% tip of the iceberg there.
Another one I went in not knowing anything about it. I went into the cinema, I just heard loads of hype, and I thought, I'd read a brief synopsis, and I thought, this doesn't sound like my kind of thing, really. And I just came out just glowing with what I just witnessed. And we're getting more of it. I mean, more and more of these risks are being taken. I feel really conscious saying any of this because I currently have my writing and directing debut in developments. So I don't want this to sound like I'm doing a kind of, hey guys, take risks on new voices and putting my hand up. But it is a beautiful thing to see. And it is, having spent the last year or so seeing how easy it would be to throw in the towel on a project, you know, it makes it all the more exciting when you have your past lives and A Girl Walks Home at Night.
So the rate we're going, the way I'm seeing it, we've done two writer directors on this episode of the podcast.
Yeah.
So in about a year, year and a half's time, you're coming back on and we're going to talk about yours.
It's a deal. It's a deal.
It's a deal. Before we let you go, one thing we ask of all of our guests on this podcast is just to recommend just a completely different double bill from the Studio Canal catalogue. Now, you cheated, I should point out. You sent me a list of 15 different films.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of your back catalogue, guys.
So I've picked two names just off there that we've not really talked about on the podcast before. Can you just tell us why these would be particularly recommended? So we've got The Place Beyond the Pines, first of all.
Yeah, I think it's a massively overlooked film. And weirdly, it was on the other night. I came home and it was on TV and it was in the second half, which is interesting because it's a real film of two halves.
It's quite episodic, isn't it?
It's in three, really. So you've got Ryan Gosling's character story, then you've kind of got Bradley Cooper's character story, and then you've got their children's story years on. And it's just amazing. I think it came out around the same, or in the same era, I guess, as Drive. And Drive was Gosling being incredibly cool, incredibly effortlessly sexy. And I would argue he does that as good, if not better, in Place Beyond the Pines. I think his character in this, he's a motorbike kind of stuntman. He does the Wall of Death thing where you drive round a wall kind of horizontally.
Yeah.
And he's just so cool. Again, I wonder if it is there's too many similarities, because I was going to say, another iconic jacket, more iconic smouldering, but a really good character. And I loved how you get a certain way into this film and you think, oh, is it wrapping up now?
Yep.
Like, how long has it been? Is this 88 minutes? Like, how long has it been? And then you realise, no, the next part is just starting. And it is, as I said, it is quite episodic in its nature. And I think everyone in it is fantastic. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Well, let's go shorter for the concluding part of your double bill. I think coming in at just around 90 minutes is 2020 Supernova,
yeah.
A film that got lost a little in the midst of pandemic stuff, I think.
It made my Films of the Year list. I do an end-of-year podcast every year. That's my Films of the Year. And Supernova was in there because Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth are just such a believably beautiful couple.
Yeah.
There's a podcast called Cuddle Club I'm a fan of as well. One of the questions in that is favourite on-screen cuddle. And there's a moment in this where they're in bed and they're waking up and it's just so, like, it feels like they slept there and the film crew came in the morning. Like, I believe it so much. It's like, I can't believe that they've just laid down and faked this. And it's such a beautiful story of a couple going on a road trip, essentially. And there's kind of a lot of allusion as to why they're on this road trip. But yeah, it's heartbreaking, it's beautiful, and it really, I guess, is another one that kind of leans towards cliche or stereotype and then really gently subverts it. And yeah, I just think it's a beautiful film. I think both of those lead performances are astounding.
Yeah.
And it's just so gentle and well-paced, even though it is a shorter film. So yeah, love it.
And it has an amazing cuddle in it. That's our other takeaway.
Yeah, really good cuddle. I can't recommend this cuddle enough.
Scroobius Pip, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you, mate. It's been a pleasure.
Attack the Block, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, and The Place Beyond the Pines are all available to watch now on the Studio Canal Presents channel on ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video. Supernova is available on DVD and Blu-ray. I've just got time for some news updates now from the world of Studio Canal. Now let's start with some festivities. Appreciating we're not quite at Christmas yet, here's something that might just get you in an early Yuletide mood. 1985's family favourite, Santa Claus the Movie, starring Dudley Moore and John Lithgow, has had a 4K makeover. It's returning to UK cinemas on Friday the 24th of November. And what's more, it's making its 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray debut as well, with the release set for Monday the 13th of November. Might just have another gift idea for you too. After its success at the UK box office, Celine Song's debut feature as director, Past Lives, is now available to rent via video on demand services. The acclaimed romantic drama is also confirmed for a DVD and Blu-ray release as well on December the 4th, and it'll be available to buy as a digital download from December the 1st. One more thing, I'm able to confirm that the hugely anticipated third Paddington movie, Paddington in Peru, will be in cinemas, wait for it, in November of 2024. Now how about that for an early Christmas present? I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until then, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. I'm just off to check I've double locked my front door in case aliens are invading. You can't be too careful. Ta-ta for now.